obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Terry.
Hi, Terry.
And I am, you know, I've heard people share from the podium before, and they've said that they were a grateful member of Al-Anon, and I thought, I'm never going to say that. And I find myself here this evening thinking, you know what? I get it. I get it today. I get what it means to be a grateful member of Al-Anon. And then it occurred to me as I was thinking about that, that my guess is that my family and my friends are probably pretty grateful too. You'll find out more about that in a little bit. The first thing I want to do is to say thank you from the bottom of my heart to Cindy and Bear for asking me to speak tonight. I just can't thank you enough. I love you guys so much. And the next thing I want to do is thank the committee for, I mean, this, I don't know if you guys have ever been on a committee before, but it takes a lot to put it together. And so the Al-Anon committee, the AA committee, you know, you guys being willing to do this, you know, if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't be here. It wouldn't be possible. So thank you for all your hard work and bringing us together. Conventions, roundups, these kinds of things have been a huge part of my recovery, and I'm so glad that they're here. The next people I want to thank is, and I heard a speaker actually do this, and I just loved it, and I'm going to steal it, so there you have it. He thanked the AAs. Anybody who here is in the AA program, thank you for lending us your 12 steps and allowing Al-Anon to exist today, because without it, I would be insane, and that is a promise. So thank you. Okay, so I attended my first Al-Anon meeting on January 30th, 1994. So that means this past January, I celebrated 21 years in Al-Anon, and boy, has it flown by fast. And I just want to say that because, you know, for this kid who grew up in an alcoholic home, which I'm going to share with you guys here in a moment, I ran from everything and everyone, and so to be here anywhere for 21 years is pretty amazing for me. So I'll share what it was like. I'm not from California originally. I was born in the state of Pennsylvania. My parents were very young when they got married. My mom was 16. My dad was 18. My dad graduated from high school. My parents got married, and they had their first child, not necessarily in that order, all in one year. By the time my mom was 23, she had 5 children. And the fun began, really, the fun began. My father decided, I don't even know why he decided to, but he decided to join the Navy is what he did. And, you know, that kind of, that was, I'm sure, was to support the family. But we ended up living all over the place. I've never lived in, you know, as a matter of fact, until I came to California, specifically this area in California, I'd never lived any place more than 2 or 3 years. So I can remember the very first time that I went to the grocery store when I moved here and I ran into somebody I knew. I thought, yay, I know somebody at the grocery store, you know? My childhood was really difficult. I try to frequently just share from the perspective that it was an alcoholic home. I believe that the disease is generational in my family. I believe that one of my parents has a problem. I have a problem with their drinking. I believe that I have grandparents that had a problem with their drinking, and probably it goes back from there. So because my parents were just basically children themselves, and then you combine the disease with that, and then you combine never living in one place for very long, it created a pretty uncomfortable environment. And one of the things I remember, well, I'll just say it. Basically, it was a very violent alcoholic home, and that's what I want to say. Now, for those of you who have come into the program, the Al-Anon, and have a child that's got the disease or have a parent or, a husband or a spouse, you know, I've had really bad relationships in my lifetime, but the disease for me started in my childhood. You know, it was the family disease for us. And my very first memory, as a matter of fact, was I think I was 5 or 6, somewhere around there. And I remember my parents screaming and yelling at each other. I don't know what they were screaming about. And I remember them throwing things. And I just remember terror. That's my very first memory of life, is being terrified. we were living in Pennsylvania at the time, and my sister, I'm the second of 5 girls, by the way, all girls, and my older sister was 7 or 8, and I was 5 or 6, and we decided that we were going to run away from home. Now, you know things aren't good when an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old went away from home. So we packed peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and put them in brown paper bags, and we were living out in this, it was like farmland. My father was actually going to university. He went to Penn State University. And we walked to the end of our lane and hid under the trees and ran away from home under the trees. Of course, when it got dark, we went back home because it was cold and, you know, we were young, but that's what it was like. That's, you know, I mean, I could just go on and, you know, regale with stories about, you know, the way it was like. My father, because he went to university, became an officer, and we in the military world call them military brats, and that's what I was pretty much the rest of my growing up years, moving from place to place. And what I remember most about my childhood, beside the violence, was like living in this little cocoon of my family. It was like you don't talk to other people, and you don't let other people in, and you don't let them know what's going on, and this was just the way it was done. Now, in today's world with the military, a lot of things that I see anyway is where, you know, they're welcoming home the soldiers, and, you know, there's all kinds of services available to them, and I'm grateful that that's the case. But back then, in the 60s and 70s, that was not the case for us. So, it was tough, you know, it was hard, and you know, moving all the time, I call them built-in geographics, you know, it was just the way it was. You just didn't get close to anybody. There was one summer, we were living in Jacksonville, Florida at the time, and I remember something happened in the neighborhood. I don't remember what it was. It was 1969. Predominantly white neighborhood, obviously, and something happened, and my mother and father restricted us to the backyard for the rest of the year, and we were not allowed to talk to anybody. We were not allowed to see people. We were not allowed to play with other kids. We had to stay in the backyard, and that was that. And I still, to this day, I'm not even sure why that happened, but, you know, I remember we had one of those above-ground pools, and I remember being in that pool like the whole summer. My hair turned green. I was in the pool so much, you know. And I just remember laying in the pool and floating in the pool and looking at the clouds and just wanting to disappear. I just wanted to disappear. And that basically is the story of my life. When my parents got really into their arguments and fights and were throwing things and all those kinds of things, I would hide under my bed. I just find that really sad today, that any child has to endure that. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a crier. I bring my own tissues. I always buy the ones that have the lotion because they're more sensitive on my little face. So I actually have a sponsee who says, I love my sponsor. She has the best tissues. at one point, we moved from Florida up to Washington State. Up in the northern part of the state is a little, well, it's not a little island, it's a big island. It's called Whidbey Island. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. And my dad got stationed there, and I spent pretty much all of my high school years in that one place, and we only had a three-year high school. And what I remember the most about that experience was it almost got militaristic. That's the best way I can describe it. We were instructed basically to say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, to everybody. We didn't call adults by their first name. It was Mr. This and Mrs. That. We always had to babysit my father and mother's friends that were also officers in the military. I can remember, as a matter of fact, I think I was 16 or 17, and I had this boyfriend, and there was going to be this great big huge New Year's Eve party, and I wanted to go to the New Year's Eve party, and my mother accepted a babysitting job for me, and I couldn't go to the party, and boy, was I pissed. I don't know if I should say that. Anyway, so that that was kind of the way life was. And a lot of what happened in that environment was there was a lot of parties, a lot of military, the one officer inviting all the other, bigwigs, I call them, to the party, and, throwing these great big parties and making all this Italian food because I'm Italian. And there was tons of alcohol, and everybody got drunk, and that's just the way it was. And basically what happened for us, my sisters and I, was we helped to put everything together. We helped clean the house. We helped make the food. We set the table. We got everything ready, and then we were told to go in the bedroom and stay there. And basically the message for us was, you are to be seen and not heard. And basically, that was it. And my father, he was gone a lot, by the way. I don't know if you know this about the military, but he was what they call an aviator, which meant he flew the jets. And they would go on deployment, and he would be gone for 9 months at a time. And basically that left my mother to raise us. And that's pretty much how I felt about it. I at one point in my lifetime, I had an opportunity to sit down and make a timeline of my life. And I could not actually come up with one moment in my lifetime where my father was nurturing and affectionate toward me, ever. And to this day, I still have difficulty when he hugs. It's like a little, it's like, it doesn't feel like a hug. And I'm used to you guys' hugs, you give these big, hold me hugs. And sometimes it's like, let go. So it's still really hard for me. Now, what I do want to say in defense of my parents is that, I know that they did the best they could. I know that. It was a different day. It was a different time. The disease was very prominent in my family. They were young. They grew up in the disease. I have no idea what their life was like when they were children. I will tell you this about my mother. Her daddy, my grandfather, who I did not know very well, was a coal miner. So I am actually a coal miner's granddaughter. I can tell you how it occurred to me. We were sitting at dinner this evening, and some people were talking about watching the big fight tomorrow night. And they were talking about the old way of watching TV with the antennas. And I said to them, did you guys ever put hot dogs on the antenna? And everybody was like, no, I never did that. I'm thinking, see, I'm a coal miner's granddaughter. We would put, it helps with the reception on the old antennas, I promise you. Does something to the, it just does. And we would put little pieces of hot dog on the antenna to get a better reception. Living in the hills of Pennsylvania, Anyway, I know. I almost forgot about that until we were talking about it at dinner time. So, but in defense of my parents, I've been around long enough. I've done enough fourth steps to know that they did the best they could, and I do not have any animosity or anger or resentment toward them today for what happened, because I know that, you know, if I was in their, I mean, to this day, I think about my mother trying to raise five girls on her own, you know, by the time she was 23, you know, I didn't even have my child until I was 26, and even then, I don't think I was ready. So, you know, I take my hat off to her for doing that. And the other thing I want to say about talking about my folks and my family, too, is that I believe that you guys get it, and you would welcome both parents to these rooms, regardless of what I shared about them, because you get it. You get that this is a disease. You get that we just do the best we can. So today I can honestly and sincerely say that I love both of my parents, and I have a relationship with them that I never thought I would have. One of the things that happened for me, though, but growing up in that home like that, was that my mom was a very angry, untreated Al-Anon. And I do remember moments in time where my dad would be, you know, he would go to work, and then he would go to happy hour afterward, which was very common, go to the officers' club, have some drinks, not come home till 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And my mom doing stuff like looking out the window to see if he's coming home yet, locking the door because she wasn't going to let him in because she was ticked off at him for doing what he did. And then when she finally did open the door to let him in, it was, you know, all hell broke loose. And there was one time where something like that happened, and we were living in Jacksonville, Florida, and my older sister, who was kind of like a little mother hen, that's kind of how I describe her, she just took the five of us, and, you know, she's only 2 years older than me, by the way. She's not, you know, a lot older than me, but she took the five of us, the four of the younger ones, and we all just were holding on to each other in a corner in the room on the floor, terrified by what was going on, you know, and that was kind of my life growing up, you know. And the thing about that that I get today is that that's not normal, you know. I thought growing up that that was normal, that that was the way everybody did it. And yet, you know, nobody talked about it. And it was like, you know, you just, I don't know, at some point in my life, I just decided that I'm just not going to feel. You know, a lot of what we also, what I heard a lot, and I'm sure some of you have heard this too, is, you know, the whole, I think it was more common back then than today, but what are you crying for? I'll give you something to cry about, you know? And it was like, you just don't feel. At some point in there, you just shut down. And that's precisely what happened to me. And basically, at the age of 13, I found him. You know, none of you get that, right? And you know, at 13, what do you know at 13, right? You know, every guy thereafter that, you know, I ever had a relationship with him, you know, it didn't matter. It was, you know, anybody to get me out of where I was at. And that was it. That was, you know, that's it. That's my life. Story's over. See you later. Bye. you know, so, excuse me. So then I moved to California, you know, when I was 17. I came to California. We had the fortune to actually move to Monterey for the first 3 years I lived in California. That was really nice. And then we moved down here eventually. And I remember... Now, you got to remember, I'm, you know, in my high school years living on a little, on an island up on the northwestern part of Washington State, where I think we had one black family in the whole town, all white people otherwise, a lot of Scandinavians settled up there, and we were driving in the RV down Oxnard Boulevard. This is in 1979, I think it was. And I looked out the window, and I said to my dad, Are we in Mexico? I hadn't seen Latinos. I hadn't seen Hispanics. I knew nothing about it. As a matter of fact, when we drove through LA the first time, I remember saying, I said, you know, what street is that? And then I said, Sepulveda, you know. That's how I pronounced it, Sepulveda, you know. And forget pronouncing Ojai. Right. So anyway, we ended up here in this area. We lived at Point Magoo when I first got here. And, my dad wanted boys. He didn't want girls. It was just all there was to it. And I remember one time a few years back, my husband and I had an RV and a truck, and we took it up to the Rincon, and I had to parallel park this 34-foot RV with a truck. And my husband got there and said, oh, my God, I can't believe you did that. And my dad said, I didn't raise my girls to be no sissies. And that was just the way life was. So back to 1979 when we first got here, you know, I had graduated from high school already, and it was like, you know, what am I going to do? You know, I go to college, go to the local, you know, junior college, but I didn't have a car, so I got a motorcycle. And I rode a motorcycle for several years. I still have my motorcycle license, as a matter of fact. It's funny, I have to tell you this story. When I first went and got my motorcycle license, I was a little nervous. You know, I'd never done that kind of a test before. I didn't really like tests anyway. Practically ran down the person that was giving the test, and she still passed me. I do not know how. I think it was because I was the only girl amongst a bunch of guys, and it was like, yeah, there's a girl riding a motorcycle. Let's do this, you know? So anyway, that just was the way it was. I just rode a motorcycle around for a couple of years. At one point, what ended up happening was and this happened when we were still living in various other places. We would go to the local enlisted club, because there you can get in when you're 18. You can't drink unless you're in the military if you're under 21, but, you know, they get around that all the time. The guys that were in the military would just go buy pitchers of beer, and then we would just drink the beer sitting at the table. And I met this guy, him, you know, capital H, and 30 days later, we got married. Yep, that's gonna fix it, right? And that's exactly what I did. Now, interestingly enough, that marriage did last for 8 years, surprisingly so. I actually moved back to Minnesota for a little while. Too cold. Ooh. We went back there in February. That was nuts. Ended up coming back to California. 4 years into the marriage, I decided I'm going to fix it again. Let's have a baby. That'll fix it. So I had my daughter at the time. Now, what I do want to say that, because she is sitting in this room tonight, is that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And you'll see on here, if I have enough time, about some of the stories of some of the stuff that I've had experiences with her. I don't want to go too much into a lot of detail about my past too much, because I want to share what happened. And so, long story short, had my daughter, got divorced. 2 years later, got remarried. 2 years later, got divorced. You know, I'm going to just keep fixing it and fixing it and fixing it, you know. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. You know, what's wrong here? Now, when my second husband chose to leave, it was literally, he woke up one day and just said, I'm unhappy. I gotta go. And he left. It was like, what? I had no idea. Had no idea it was coming. And that had a huge impact on me. And I'm gonna transgress just a bit, going back to something that happened about 8-9 months prior to that. What happened, is it hot in here or is it me? Oh. I wanted to tell, my daughter was talking to me the other day. She's a grown adult by now, just for those of you who don't know her. And we were having this conversation about senior moments and, you know, turning 50-something and, you know, all that fun stuff. And I thought, you know, because we were talking about it, because I was thought, well, what happens if I get up there and I forget things, which happens a lot these days, you know, they call them senior moments. And she said, hey, I heard somebody once say that senior moments are nothing but the fact that you get to a certain age where you have so much information in your head that you have to drop bits of it out to make room for more information. And I'm like, okay, I like that. That's what I'm going to do. So if I drop pieces out, I'm just making room for more, okay? So anyway, one day my daughter, well, it was actually over a period of a couple of weeks, my daughter spent a lot of time in and out of the doctor's office with sinus infections. And she was probably about 7 years old at the time, and she got really sick. And I didn't know what was going on. And it was like, so I took her to the doctor, and they put her on antibiotics for the umpteenth time. And she wasn't getting any better. And I was like, okay, something's wrong, you know. So I called them back up, and I end up actually talking to the doctor. And he says, I think we need to see her. And they did some blood tests, and it turned out that she had juvenile diabetes. For those of you who are not familiar with it, that's type 1 diabetes. And what happens is that their pancreas does not make insulin anymore at all. And so they have to live on insulin the rest of their lives, either by taking physical injections or by having an insulin pump. So they put her in the hospital right away. And I remember she was 7, and she was laying in this bed, and she was just crying, Mommy, make them stop. They're poking me and it hurts. Just make them stop. And I couldn't fix her. I couldn't fix it. For the first time in my life, there was nothing I could do to fix her or it or anything for that matter. And I have to tell you, that was probably my very first surrender. In all honesty, it was my first surrender. Now, I had been working at a place for several years, about 5 years, I think, when this all happened with my daughter. And interestingly, one of the very first people I got comfortable with and that I got really close to had a higher power. She had a God of her understanding, and she would talk about that God a lot. And I just couldn't believe it. It's like, you know, it was like I fought it the whole way. I had to argue as to why there was no God. And she just persisted. And basically what happens over the period of next 5 years, I promoted up, and everywhere I went, there was a person that had a God in their life who tried to talk to me about God. And every time I was like, how can there be a God who would let this kind of stuff happen to me as a kid growing up, or to any child for that matter? And I couldn't get it. And when she was diagnosed with her diabetes and she was laying in that bed, I had that very first woman come to the room and talk to me about God. And I had an aha moment for the first time in my life. And that aha moment was, there has to be something bigger out there if even the best, most educated minds in the world cannot fix her. There has to be something bigger. 8 months later, the husband leaves. I end up in a lot of pain, and I knew that I didn't want to keep doing it the same old way. And I didn't get here trying to get an alcoholic sober. That's not what brought me here. What brought me here was I knew something was wrong with me. Something was going on with me that was causing me to not be able to do life. So, through a series of phone calls, I ended up talking to this woman. She took me out to breakfast. It was a Sunday morning. I remember it very well. We were having conversations. I was sharing stuff about my past that I would have never shared with anybody, that I didn't even know that I could even verbalize. And she said to me, it sounds like you need Al-Anon. Now, I'd never heard about Al-Anon, ever. Didn't even know it existed, didn't know what it was. So for anybody out there who does public outreach, more power to you, because there are people out there that don't know about it. And that very night, I was in such pain that she said, let me take you to a meeting. And she took me to the Sunday night Al-Anon meeting. I think it was at 7 o'clock. It was on Main Street, at what was then the Alcohol and Drug Center, I think. It was upstairs in a room. It was a pretty nice size meeting. I don't remember everybody that was there. I don't even remember everything that was said, but what I do remember was Bear being there. And he had his little baby girl, who was probably 8 months old at the time, with beautiful red hair. And there was a man being loving and nurturing to a child. It touched me. And then I remember hearing you guys talk about stuff that I could not talk about ever, ever. And the key to that, in that moment that I remember the most, was the identification. I identified. One of these days I'm going to get up here and talk and not cry, I promise. Anyway, or fall over. So that was it. That's what started it. That was the day, January 30th, 1994. My life has not been the same. It took me 4 months to find a sponsor in Al-Anon, and it was because, for me, it was really, really hard to ask. And I do remember when I did call my first sponsor, I called her up asking her how you find a sponsor, knowing that I wanted to ask her to be my sponsor, but afraid to ask. And, you know, the words just blurted out at some point in the conversation. And she became, she was my sponsor for about 5 years, and she became my best friend, something I had not had growing up in that home. She knew everything about me that I had never shared with anybody. And I am still friends with her to this day. Now, she doesn't live here anymore. Her husband has a position that required them to move all over the world. But we stay in touch. And I used to see her every summer. She would come and visit. And it was, you know, she's just a dear friend. One of the things that happened to me when I first got into program is that they would do these women's retreats. Now, I didn't get close to anybody, and it didn't matter if it was a man or a woman. I just didn't let you guys in. And they were sitting there talking about loving each other and, you know, letting us love you until you can love yourself. And I remember laying in the bed, twin beds, we were facing each other, and I was saying, you know what, I don't know how to let you love me. And she said, doesn't matter, we love you anyway. And that was probably the first time I really got it, that you guys were going to love me no matter how hard I tried for you not to love me, you know, because that's what I want to do. I do this thing that I've realized over the years, and it's taken me a while to figure it out, but I do this come here, go away, come here, go away, come here, go away thing. You know, because the bottom line is, and the truth is that I am a human being who needs to be loved just like anybody else. But when I let you get too close, I'm afraid of getting hurt. So I push you away. And I'm still, 21 years later, working on that. Some of us are slow learners. But I did learn something. And I will share it in a few minutes. So, you know, that's, you know, my journey in program has just basically been lots and lots and lots of meetings, working the steps repeatedly, multiple fourth steps. I had a whole bunch of conventions and roundups and buying speaker tapes and CDs. Back then, when I first started, they were tapes. Now they're CDs. and listening to them while driving and just listening to them over and over and over again, because there's so much wisdom that we get from hearing other people share about all of this stuff that, you know, when people just really share from the heart and you get that identification, and it just speaks to me. You know, it's like there's a book out there called The Language of the Heart, and that this is the only place I've ever experienced that, ever in my whole life. I'm right now, I have a spiritual director. She's not in program now. And I'm doing a book study with that spiritual director. And I find myself in, the book is really good. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that. But I find myself not wanting to open up so much in that book study because it's not you guys, you know. You guys know, you know. I mean, I could sit up here. I was, before the meeting started, some stuff has happened to me in the last month that's been really hard. And I kind of feel it basically has brought me back to my knees. And why am I crying so much?
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Anyway, I was thinking that, you know, growing up in an alcoholic home where there was a lot of invisibility and wanting to hide and be anybody but me, that, you know, after being in program for a while, I finally felt like I had a voice and I wanted to share. And so I got asked to speak and was like, yes, I'm going to tell my story. I get to share. And then this thing happened a month ago and I was saying, I don't feel like I have anything to share. Somebody said, maybe that's a good place to be. Because then you can just get out of the way and let God do what God needs to do. And so that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm just up here sharing whatever comes out of my mouth and believing that it's God. And that somebody's going to hear something that they need to hear. Because that's what happened to me. All those speakers and all those, you know, conventions, I always heard something that I needed to hear. So, one of the things that has happened in the last couple of months is that I've had another aha, a real aha moment. I've had a lot of aha moments over the years. I just want you to know that. I always wanted an aha moment like Bill had. I wanted, you know, I wanted the white light and, you know, the heavens to open. And, you know, I always wanted something like that. Because then you know for sure it's from God, right? Because I tend to be a doubter, in case you hadn't noticed. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that I'm a logical thinker. I am not what I would call a real creative person. I tend to think with the part of my brain that's logical more than anything. A lot of you know this already, but my favorite show in the whole wide world is Star Trek. Spock. Spock is my favorite character, live long and prosper. I cried when Leonard Nimoy died. You know, I'm a logical thinker, and I want everything to be logical, and life isn't logical. And I have spent many a year in program even going, I believe in God. Well, maybe not. Okay, yeah, maybe there is a God, but well, maybe not, you know. And I can just talk myself right out of believing in a God, quite frankly. And it's as simple as saying, well, you know, if God is in the group conscience, and most people are, you know, especially those of us who've been affected by the disease, are really just looking out for ourselves, then everybody's just voting in the group conscience for what they want, and it's really not a God conscious thing at all, right? You guys see the logic in that? That's my brain. Aren't you glad you don't live here? Anyway, but one of the things that I had this realization about, I was at an Al-Anon meeting. Now, I do Al-Anon meetings regularly, at least 3 a week for the most part, unless I'm in the hospital or something like that. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who I believe has a sponsor. I sponsor people. I do what I need to do to stay in this program. I do what I need to do to work the program. And one of the things that I heard by a speaker was quite some time ago, and he was talking about how his program wasn't working, and his sponsor said to him, "Well, why don't you try our program?" And I liked that because, you know, so I try real hard to work you guys' program, not my very own program, all except for the doubting part. Anyway, I was in a meeting, and I don't even remember I think it might have been about letting go or something like that. And even though I had done multiple fourth steps on my childhood, I realized in that moment at this meeting, this aha moment, that I was still holding on to my past. I wasn't angry at my folks anymore. I wasn't angry at any one person in particular, quite frankly. I was just angry that it had to happen, period. And I didn't know who or what. You know, it's like a lot of what I had learned and a lot of what I had got growing up in the disease of alcoholism was a lot of blame. And I wanted to blame, you know. I wanted to blame somebody or something for what had happened to me. And there was nobody to blame. I don't believe that my parents sat there and decided that they were going to do what they did just to treat me like crap, you know. I didn't believe that. I don't believe that God made it happen. I don't believe that either. Because I don't believe that that's the way the God that I understand today works. But it happened for whatever reason. And I had this aha moment of, Terry, you have to let go of the past. Now, I heard a speaker years ago, and you guys are going to hear me say that a lot. I heard a speaker say, because I listen to a lot of speakers. They have a lot of good information, you know. And I heard this speaker say, the pain isn't in letting go. It's in holding on to something it's time to let go of. And it was time. It was time to let go of the past. I also heard a speaker say, you guys, you have to let go of any hope of a better past. I mean, really, think about that. Because I get that today. The past isn't going to change. It is what it was. And then, after that experience, I went home and I decided that I'm going to work your program. I'm going to start praying and meditating on a daily basis. And that's precisely what I've been doing for a while now. And I started writing about some of the stuff that was coming up during that prayer and meditation. And I had another aha moment. And that aha moment was, what happens if you're wrong? What happens if everything that happened to you was exactly the way it was supposed to be? That there was a reason for it all. And everything just, whoosh, suddenly it was all okay. I just didn't have that anger anymore about my past, you know? Now, I have family members who are still struggling with a lot of what happened to us. I have a sister. Sometimes I never know quite how much to share, but there was some sexual molestation in it, too. And for sure, what I know is that it happened to me and it happened to one of my other sisters. And she's got some stuff going on in her life right now. She lives in Seattle. And she called me actually just recently and she said she was in tears and she was going to do this group thing that's dealing with all this stuff in her past. And She said, "Oh, I've done therapy about this," in tears. "I've done therapy about all of this. I thought I dealt with this." She said, "I don't know why I'm crying." And I said, "Well, maybe you just thought you dealt with it and you just didn't, you know, because it's pretty deep stuff." And she said, and she was just crying and crying, and I said, "You know, my experience has been," and this is something you guys taught me, "my experience has been," senior moment, there it went, "my experience has taught me that tears are a form of prayer, and it's okay to cry about this. You know, this is tough stuff." Now, I have no family members other than immediate, my husband and my daughter, who are in program. None of my other extended family members are in program, with the exception of one nephew who actually went to NA. He lives in Seattle. So it seems to me, and this is another gift of the program, if you ask me, is that my family, my sisters particularly, call me a lot about various stuff that are happening in their life that have to do with this disease, because they trust me to talk to me about it, and I don't have to fix it for them. I don't have to tell them what they should be doing. I just get to share my experience, strength, and hope, and what you guys taught me. And, you know, it takes me back to that place of thinking, maybe it happened for that everything that's happened to me has happened for a reason. You know, who else would they go to, you know? So, anyway, I kind of feel like I've been all over the place with all of this stuff, but a few weeks ago, maybe more than a month ago, my daughter and I were taking a walk, and I don't remember what we were talking about, and she said to me, it had to do with getting somewhere or being somewhere or, you know, plans or whatever, and she said to me, "Mom, you and I are all about the destination, not the journey." And I've really had an opportunity to sit and think about that, because, you know, when I look back on my life and I look back on all that's happened, I got here to Al-Anon when I was 35, I think I was. I have huge chunks of my childhood that I don't have memories of. I wasn't encouraged to go to university. I didn't get a college degree. I didn't have what I would call a career. I am 56 going on 57 and still don't know what I want to be when I grow up, you know. But one of the things I do know is that this disease has taken enough of my life . By the way, I'm okay if you cry too, okay? I don't want to be alone, you know? It's taken enough of my life, and I'm done. That does not mean I'm suicidal, by the way. That's not what that means. What it means is that it's time to move on. It's time to live my life. Start being about the journey and not the destination. Stop being about getting through it and surviving, which is what we do, you know. So one of the things that I've realized as a result of wanting to do that and live my life is really just, like I shared, I'm doing prayer and meditation, and I'm reading a lot of literature, program literature specifically, and one of the One of the things that I grew up on, let me put it this way, in the Al-Anon program, I grew up on AA literature. I know that there are some people that have difficulty in Al-Anon because it's not conference approved, but this is just my experience, and that's what I'm sharing with you. And there is so much information in the AA literature that pertains to us. One of the things that I learned from listening to speakers, yet again, I don't know if you guys remember Rick J. He came here a couple of years ago. And one of the things that I remember him saying, I got his CD, by the way. One of the things I remember him saying is, at first, because he grew up in the disease too, at first we're affected by the disease, and then we're inflicted with it. And that has really struck a chord for me, because I get that, you know. I get that. That it's the ism. It's not the alcohol. It's the ism. And in a piece of AA literature that I've been reading recently, it talks about what the problem is. And I've never read it before. And I kind of got it when I got here in program, but somewhere it got lost along the way. And what it says is that it's our emotional deformities, our painful relationships, and our unmanageable situations. And that's it. That's it in a nutshell. And I get that. that's why I found him, you know? I wanted to not have all of that, you know? And so, as a result of looking at that, I've also been looking at some of the other stuff, and ego is one of them. And to look at me, to listen to me share, to hear you guys, to hear me share with you that I just wanted to disappear and hide under the bed and be invisible, you would think that I didn't have much of an ego, which is what my brain will tell me, by the way, that I don't have an ego. And one of the things that I've learned by reading AA literature is that I do have an ego, and it's pretty damn big, by the way, but my ego's in reverse. And I didn't get that. It's like, okay, somebody explain that to me, because, you know, I'm dumb and I need help, you know. And that first Al-Anon sponsor of mine actually helped me to understand it. And how I describe it today is, it's like walking into a room. If any person with an ego walks into a room, if your ego's in forward, you want everybody to look at you because you want that attention. For me, I walk into a room and I'm afraid everybody's looking at me, but I still think they're looking at me. You know, that's my ego. And I had the opportunity recently to look up the word ego, because I'm a logical thinker. I want to know what it means. So I look words up. And I looked up the word ego and egotism specifically. And what it described was a an exaggerated sense of self-importance. And I'm like, wow. I don't know about you guys, but that holds a lot for me. Because when I think about, like, trying to tell people what to do and how to do it and being controlling, I mean, isn't that what I'm doing? You know, somehow I know what's best for you, you know? I don't know a damn thing. And that's probably part of what this whole last month and this being back on my knees thing has done for me. It's allowed to see me, to see that I don't know a damn thing. You know, I have experiences to share. I can share what you guys have shared. I can share what other speakers have shared. But when it comes to doing life, I don't know how to do it. And that's what this disease does. I heard an Al-Anon speaker once say that it robs us of our hopes and dreams. I would add, it robs us of our life. You know, for this Al-Anon, it did. I have tissues. Does anybody need tissues? I bring my own. So, this ego-driven, scared, afraid Al-Anon, who doesn't know anything, has learned a whole hell of a lot from you guys.
And, you know, if I look back on perhaps what my life might have been if I didn't have program, I'm pretty sure I would be just like my mother. And I love my mother, don't get me wrong, but there is nothing worse, in my opinion, than somebody say to me, "You remind me of your mother." Do not say that to me. And because what I can share with you about my mother today is that she's a very afraid, very alone. She's divorced from my father. They divorced many years ago. Very scared person. And I just don't, I don't think, when I got here, you know, in Al-Anon, I've heard people say that when you get here, you're either homicidal or suicidal. I was not homicidal, not at all, but I was definitely suicidal. And one of the things that I've experienced in this, in these rooms, is I try really hard to have fun and make light of stuff, and I really do. By the way, I'm not always like this, you know, and but some of it's hard, you know, and some of it's really serious stuff. Even though I try to make light of it, you know, it is. It's really serious stuff. It's life-taking stuff, you know. And I was suicidal when I got here, and I love my program today. I love your program today because it's the thing that saved my life, you know. There's no doubt in my mind about it. And when things happen in the rooms, and it kind of feels like it's tilting the program for me, it's like, no, no, you can't. This is serious stuff for me. This is life for me. It's easier to think that about the AA program because, you know, a lot of what they do in that program or before they're in recovery is far more seriously life-taking than some of the stuff that I've experienced anyway. But this program is just as important and just as serious as that other program, you know? It's very possible I might have taken my life if it wasn't for this program. And this, you know, I shared that this is a generational disease in my family. And one thing I forgot to share with you guys, it was a lesson that I had learned on, actually reasonably early on, was, you know, it was hard for me to let go of my past, but it was easier for me to let go of some of you guys, specifically my daughter. When she was 8, somewhere around there, my husband left, and it was just her and I, and it was just her and I for a really long time, for about another 7 or 8 years, and we did everything together. As a matter of fact, when I first started coming to Al-Anon, she was 9, and I drug her everywhere. I was like, I don't care, I'm going to a meeting, you know, and she went with me, and eventually she got into Alateen, and of course she was dealing with her chronic illness, and when she was 16, I think it was, she decided that she was kind of done with being, you know, having juvenile diabetes. She didn't want to deal with it. She just, you know, those teenage years, you know, they're tough. Anyway, so ironically, what she did was she tried to take her own life with insulin, and she basically overdosed on insulin. And it was ironic in that the one thing that was going to save her was the one thing she chose to use to kill herself. Anyway, we found out about it. We ended up taking her to the hospital. She was in the critical intensive care unit. And I remember driving home from that experience and thinking, I don't know what to do. It was probably one of the most deep surrenders I've ever experienced in my life. I realized in that moment there was nothing I could do to keep her alive. Nothing. It was out of my hands, out of my control. And I started praying, because you guys taught me to do that, you know, pray. And I started praying and driving in the car. This is probably about as close to a white light experience that I've ever gotten. I had this sense of relief just enveloped me. That's the honest to God's truth. And then this next thought that, and it sounds almost crass to some degree and selfish, but I had this thought that if anything were to happen to her, that I'd be okay, that I'd get through it. It would be tough, you know, it would be painful. I can't look at her. But I would get through it. And I know that that's you guys, you know, because I wouldn't be doing it alone, you know. It's not like growing up in that home anymore. It doesn't exist anymore. It's, you know, it's you guys. And without you, I wouldn't be here. And I wouldn't be here to share all of this. And you wouldn't have to watch me cry. So, back to the wanting to live my life. I'm reading this book. It's not a program book, but I don't know where I'm at with time, but oh, pretty close. Damn, I have to tell you, I was at dinner, my husband and I were having this conversation, and I said, I don't think I have much to say for an hour. He said, why not? You talk that long at home. He's here too, by the way. You know, I just want to share briefly. I want to share a really cool thing that's happened. Because, you know, my life in Al-Anon has actually been really cool. It hasn't been all dread, you know. It might seem like it, but it hasn't. When I got into program, my Al-Anon sponsor was married. And everybody I knew in Al-Anon was married, you know. And I was single, you know. And it was like, oh, great, you know. So we would do all the dances and the New Year's Eve stuff and everything like that. And I can remember thinking so many times, when am I going to have somebody? When is somebody going to come into my life, you know? And this went on for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. It seemed like forever to me. And one day I woke up and I had this thought, you know, if I never get married again, if I never have another relationship, I'm okay with it. That's pretty cool, you know? And it was a really cool place to be because, you know, this from the woman who found him at 13, right, you know? So what ended up happening is that very year, I went to the Santa Paula Pig Roast. Back then, it was up in near Oakview. I was camping with some Al-Anon friends, and my Al-Anon friend had an AA guy that she knew, and they came and camped with us, and he brought this newcomer. He's about 11 months in the program, and God, he was gorgeous. That's all I gotta say. I remember at one point they had an amphitheater, and I was sitting up on the amphitheater and looking down, and the sun was shining, and he's Latino, by the way, and he had black hair, and he was wearing this black turtleneck, and it was on the chilly side. This was back when it was in June, and it was still cool outside, and I just thought, God, is he good looking. I just remember having that thought. Anyway, so every time I saw him at whatever AA function was going on, I would just, you know, behave like a lady, which is what I was taught in program. You don't make the first move, you wait. Tried to just let him know I was interested without, you know, directly asking him out, you know. And after about 3 or 4 months of this, I just decided, and him not biting, I just decided, well, maybe he's just not interested. So fast forward a couple of months to the New Year's Eve dance. It was up in the fairgrounds. I was working the registration table, and him and the gentleman that he had gone camping at the pig roast with showed up, and we talked and chatted just a little bit, and then he went in and listened to the speaker, and I was working the registration desk, and after that was over, he came out and kind of didn't leave my side the rest of the night. was kind of interesting. It was adorable, in my opinion. And so we sat and talked for a long time, and we, you know, wandered here, and we got stuff to drink, and we did this, and we did that. And it was getting close to midnight, and he said to me, you know, I was thinking maybe we could go out sometime. Now, outside, I'm just calm and cool as could possibly be. Inside, jumping up and down, yay, yay, yay. The very next thing he said was, how about tomorrow night? One of my favorite stories, by the way. So then, this was the clincher, I'll tell you this. So then what he said to me, I said to him, you know, I'm just being my direct self, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve and I say what I'm going to say. And I said to him, what took you so long to ask me out? And he said, you know, women as beautiful as you can be a little intimidating, and I didn't think you'd go out with me. I know. Oh, is right. I just want you to know that this June we will celebrate 13 years of marriage. So it does work. It does work. I'd like to sit and tell you that our relationship hasn't had rocky points, but it has. And one of the most wonderful lessons, beside the one that I learned about with my daughter and how to let go of people, was to really look at myself. And that happened because at one point in our relationship, we were living together, and he did exactly what my second husband did. He got up one morning and he said, you know, I can't do this anymore. And he left. And it was like, I'm in program. I'm supposed to be recovered. I don't get this, you know. And as I was laying in bed that night crying my eyes out, I had another aha moment where I got to see myself as I really was. And what was happening is that one more time, I was trying to make him into somebody I wanted him to be. And that's not the way relationships work, you know. It took a while after that, and we started dating, and we did the dating thing for several months, 9 months, 10 months, I don't know, before he asked me to marry him, and we didn't live together, and that was probably the best thing I ever did, was to just date like a normal person, you know, not fall in love and marry him 30 days later, you know. So anyway, I have, you know, 21 years of experience and so many more stories to talk about, but I don't have enough time. So what I want to say to you all tonight is, if any of you, either whether you grew up in the disease or lived with the disease, have a husband that's an alcoholic, have a child, don't wait, you know, 50-some years to live your life. Because this is it. That's my opinion. This is it. And I was watching a movie recently. Have you guys ever seen Dead Poets Society? Great movie, by the way. And there was a quote in there that I have just glommed onto, and it's like where I'm at, you know? We get up here, we share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, and this is where I'm at today, and it's like the best place I've ever been in, ever. You know, and I'm going to end with this quote because I want this for all of you who've been affected by this disease and who have been afflicted with it. I got plenty. I went into the woods because I wanted to live deliberately. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to put to rest all that was not life. And not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. And that's by Henry David Thoreau. I love you guys so much. Thank you for my life.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.